Chapter 12. After long aeons of unconsciousness, Tommy began to be aware of a fiery ball swimming in space. In the center of the fiery ball was a core of pain. The universe shrank. The fiery ball swung more slowly. He discovered suddenly that the nucleus of it was his own aching head. Slowly he became aware of other things, of cold, cramped limbs, of hunger, of an inability to move his lips. Slower and slower swung the fiery ball. It was now Thomas Beresford's head, and it was resting on solid ground, very solid ground. In fact, something suspiciously like stone. Yes, he was lying on hard stones, and he was in pain, unable to move, extremely hungry, cold, and uncomfortable. Surely, although Mrs. Perenna's beds had never been unduly soft, this could not be... Of course. Adoc, the wireless, the German waiter, turning in at the gates of Sanssouci. Someone, creeping up behind him, had struck him down. That was the reason for his aching head. And he'd thought he'd got away with it all right. So, Adoc, after all, hadn't been quite such a fool. Adoc? Adoc had gone back into Smuggler's Rest and closed the door. How had he managed to get down the hill and be waiting for Tommy in the grounds of Sanssouci? It couldn't be done. Not without Tommy seeing him. The manservant, then. Had he been sent ahead to lie in wait? But surely, as Tommy had crossed the hall, he had seen Appledore in the kitchen, of which the door was slightly ajar. Or did he fancy he had seen him? Perhaps that was the explanation. Anyway, it didn't matter. The thing to do was to find out where he was now. His eyes, accustomed to the darkness, picked out a small rectangle of dim light. A window or small grating. The air smelled chilly and musty. He was, he fancied, lying in a cellar. His hands and feet were tied, and a gag in his mouth was secured by a bandage. "Seems rather as though I'm for it," thought Tommy. He tried gingerly to move his limbs or body, but he could not succeed. At that moment there was a faint creaking sound, and a door somewhere behind him was pushed open. A man with a candle came in. He set down the candle on the ground. Tommy recognized Appledore. The latter disappeared again and then returned carrying a tray on which was a jug of water, a glass, and some bread and cheese. Stooping down, he first tested the cords binding the other limbs. He then touched the gag. He said in a quiet, level voice, "I'm about to take this off. You will then be able to eat and drink. If, however, you make the slightest sound, I shall replace it immediately." Tommy tried to nod his head, which proved impossible, so he opened and shut his eyes several times instead. Appledore, taking this for consent, carefully unknotted the bandage. His mouth freed, Tommy spent some minutes easing his jaw. Appledore held the glass of water to his lips. He swallowed at first with difficulty, then more easily. The water did him a world of good. He murmured stiffly, "Oh, that's better. I'm not quite so young as I was. Now for the eats, Fritz, or is it France?" The man said quietly, "My name here is Appledore." He held the slice of bread and cheese up, and Tommy bit at it hungrily. The meal washed down with water, he then asked, "And what's the next part of the program?" For answer, Appledore picked up the gag again. Tommy said quickly, "I want to see Commander Haydock." Appledore shook his head. Deftly, he replaced the gag and went out. Tommy was left to meditate in darkness. He was awakened from a confused sleep by the sound of the door reopening. This time, Haydock and Appledore came in together. The gag was removed and the cords that held his arms were loosened so that he could sit up and stretch his arms. Haydock had an automatic pistol with him. Tommy, without much inward confidence, began to play his part. He said indignantly, "Look here, Haydock, what's the meaning of all this? I've been set upon, kidnapped." The commander was gently shaking his head. He said, "Don't waste your breath. It's not worth it. Just because you're a member of our Secret Service, you think you can..." Again the other shook his head. "No, no, Meadows. You weren't taken in by that story. No need to keep up the pretense." But Tommy showed no signs of discomfiture. He argued to himself that the other could not really be sure if he continued to play his part. "Who the devil do you think you are?" he demanded. "However great your powers, you've no right to behave like this. I'm perfectly capable of holding my tongue about any of our vital secrets," the other said coldly. "You do your stuff very well, but I may tell you that it's immaterial to me whether you're a member of the British intelligence or merely a muddling amateur. Of all the damn cheek. Cut it out, Meadows. I tell you—" Haydock thrust a ferocious face forwards. "Be quiet, damn you. Earlier on it would have mattered to find out who you were and who sent you. Now it doesn't matter. The time's short, you see, and you didn't have the chance to report to anyone what you'd found out. The police will be looking for me as soon as I'm reported missing." Haydock showed his teeth in a sudden gleam. "I've had the police here this evening. Good fellows, both friends of mine. They asked me all about Mr. Meadows. Very concerned about his disappearance. How he seemed that evening, what he said. They never dreamt, how should they, that the man they were talking about was practically underneath their feet where they were sitting. It's quite clear, you see, that you left this house well and alive. They'd never dream of looking for you here." "You can't keep me here forever," Tommy said vehemently. Haydock replied, "It won't be necessary, my dear fellow. Only until tomorrow night. There's a boat due in at my little cove, and we're thinking of sending you on a voyage for your health. Though actually, I don't think you'll be alive, or even on board, when they arrive at their destination. I wonder you didn't knock me on the head straight away. It's such hot weather, my dear fellow. Just occasionally our sea communications are interrupted, and if that were to be so, well, a dead body on the premises has a way of announcing its presence." "I see," said Tommy. He did see. The issue was perfectly clear. He was to be kept alive until the boat arrived. Then he would be killed or drugged, and his dead body taken out to sea. Nothing would ever connect this body, when found, with Smuggler's Rest. "I just came along," continued Haydock, speaking in the most natural manner, "to ask whether there is anything we could do for you. Afterwards." Tommy reflected. Then he said, "Thanks, but I won't ask you to take a lock of my hair to the little woman in St. John's Wood or anything of that kind. She'll miss me when payday comes along, but I dare say she'll soon find a friend elsewhere." At all costs, he felt, he must create the impression that he was playing a lone hand. So long as no suspicion attached itself to Tuppence, then the game might still be won through, though he was not there to play it. "As you please," said Haydock. "If you did care to send a message to, your friend, we would see that it was delivered." So he was, after all, anxious to get a little information about this unknown Mr. Meadows. Very well, then. Tommy would keep him guessing. He shook his head. "Nothing doing," he said. "Very well." With an appearance of the utmost indifference, Haydock nodded to Appledore. The latter replaced the bonds and the gag. The two men went out, locking the door behind them. Left to his reflections, Tommy felt anything but cheerful. Not only was he faced with the prospect of rapidly approaching death, but he had no means of leaving any clue behind him as to the information he had discovered. His body was completely helpless. His brain felt singularly inactive. Could he wondered, have utilized Haydock's suggestion of a message? Perhaps if his brain had been working better, but he could think of nothing helpful. There was, of course, still Tuppence. But what could Tuppence do? As Haydock had just pointed out, Tommy's disappearance would not be connected with him. Tommy had left Smuggler's Rest alive and well. The evidence of two independent witnesses would confirm that. Whoever Tuppence might suspect, it would not be Haydock. And she might not suspect at all. She might think that he was merely following up a trail. Damn it all. If only he had been more on his guard. There was a little light in the cellar. It came through the grating, which was high up in one corner. If only he could get his mouth free, he could shout for help. Somebody might hear, though it was very unlikely. For the next half hour, he busied himself straining at the cords that bound him and trying to bite through the gag. It was all in vain, however. The people who had adjusted those things knew their business. It was, he judged, late afternoon. Haydock, he fancied, had gone out. He had heard no sounds from overhead. Confound it all, he was probably playing golf, speculating at the clubhouse over what could have happened to Meadows. Dined with me the night before last. Seemed quite normal then, just vanished into the blue. Tommy writhed with fury. That hearty English manner. Was everyone blind not to see that bullet-headed Prussian skull? He himself hadn't seen it. Wonderful what a first-class actor could get away with. So, here he was, a failure, an ignominious failure, trussed up like a chicken, with no one to guess where he was. If only Tuppence could have second sight, she might suspect. She had, sometimes, an uncanny insight. What was that? He strained his ears, listening to a far-off sound. Only some man humming a tune. And here he was, unable to make a sound to attract anyone's attention. The humming came nearer, a most untuneful noise. But the tune, though mangled, was recognizable. It dated from the last war, had been revived for this one. If you were the only girl in the world and I was the only boy. How often had he hummed that in 1917? Dash this fellow, why couldn't he sing in tune? Suddenly, Tommy's body grew taut and rigid. Those particular lapses were strangely familiar. Surely there was only one person who always went wrong in that one particular place and in that one particular way. Albert, by gosh, thought Tommy. Albert, prowling round Smuggler's Rest. Albert, quite close at hand. And here he was, trussed up, unable to move hand or foot, unable to make a sound. Wait a minute. Was he? There was just one sound. Not so easy with the mouth shut as with the mouth open, but it could be done. Desperately, Tommy began to snore. He kept his eyes closed, ready to feign a deep sleep if Appledore should come in, and he snored. And he snored. Short snore, short snore, short snore, pause. Long snore, long snore, long snore, pause. Short snore, short snore, short snore. Albert, when Tuppence had left him, was deeply perturbed. With the advance of years, he'd become a person of slow mental processes. But those processes were tenacious. The state of affairs in general seemed to him quite wrong. The war was all wrong to begin with. Those Germans, thought Albert gloomily, and almost without rancour, hiling Hitler and goose-stepping and overrunning the world and bombing and machine-gunning and generally making pestilential nuisances of themselves. They'd got to be stopped, no two ways about it. And so far it seemed as though nobody had been able to stop them. And now here was Mrs. Beresford, a nice lady if ever there was one, getting herself mixed up in trouble and looking out for more trouble. And how was he going to stop her? Didn't look as though he could. Up against this fifth column, and a nasty lot they must be. Some of them English-born, too. A disgrace, that was. And the master, who was always the one to hold the missus back from her impetuous ways, the master was missing. Albert didn't like that at all. It looked to him as though those Germans might be at the bottom of that. Yes, it looked bad, it did. Looks as though he might have copped one. Albert was not given to the exercise of deep reasoning. Like most Englishmen, he felt something strongly, and proceeded to muddle around until he had somehow or other cleared up the mess. Deciding that the master had got to be found, Albert, rather after the manner of a faithful dog, set out to find him. He acted upon no settled plan, but proceeded in exactly the same way as he was wont to embark upon the search for his wife's missing handbag or his own spectacles when either of those essential articles were mislaid. That is to say, he went to the place where he had last seen the missing objects and started from there. In this case, the last thing known about Tommy was that he had dined with Commander Haydock at Smuggler's Rest and had then returned to Sanssouci and been last seen turning in at the gate. Albert, accordingly, climbed the hill as far as the gate of Sanssouci and spent some 5 minutes staring hopefully at the gate. Nothing of a scintillating character having occurred to him, he sighed and wandered slowly up the hill to Smuggler's Rest. Albert, too, had visited the ornate cinema that week and had been powerfully impressed by the theme of Wandering Minstrel. Romantic it was. He could not but be struck by the similarity of his own predicament. He, like that hero of the screen, Larry Cooper, was a faithful Blondel, seeking his imprisoned master. Like Blondel, he had fought at that master's side in bygone days. Now his master was betrayed by treachery, and there was none but his faithful Blondel to seek for him and restore him to the loving arms of Queen Berengaria. Albert heaved a sigh, as he remembered the melting strains of Richard O'Morroy, which the faithful troubadour had crooned so feelingly beneath tower after tower. Pity he himself wasn't better at picking up a tune. Took him a long time to get hold of a tune, it did. His lips shaped themselves into a tentative whistle. Begun playing the old tunes again lately, they had. If You Were the Only Girl in the World, and I Was the Only Boy. Albert paused to survey the neat white-painted gate of Smuggler's Rest. That was it. That was where the master had gone to dinner. He went up the hill a little farther, and came out on the downs. Nothing here, nothing but grass and a few sheep. The gate of Smuggler's Rest swung open, and a car passed out. A big man in plus fours with golf clubs drove out and down the hill. That would be Commander Haydock, that would, Albert deduced. He wandered down again and stared at Smuggler's Rest. A tidy little place. Nice bit of garden. Nice view. He eyed it benignly. I would say such wonderful things to you, he hummed. Through a side door of the house, a man came out with a hoe and passed out of sight through a little gate. Albert, who grew nasturtiums and a bit of lettuce in his back garden, was instantly interested. He edged nearer to Smuggler's Rest and passed through the open gate. Yes, tidy little place. He circled slowly round it. Some way below him, reached by steps, was a flat plateau planted as a vegetable garden. The man who had come out of the house was busy down there. Albert watched him with interest for some minutes. Then he turned to contemplate the house. Tidy little place, he thought for the third time. Just the sort of place a retired naval gentleman would like to have. This was where the master had dined that night. Slowly, Albert circled round and round the house. He looked at it much as he had looked at the gate of Sanssouci, hopefully, as though asking it to tell him something. And as he went, he hummed softly to himself, a 20th-century blondel, in search of his master. There would be such wonderful things to do, hummed Albert. I would say such wonderful things to you. There would be such wonderful things to do. Gone wrong somewhere, hadn't he? He'd hummed that bit before. Hello. Funny. So, the commander kept pigs, did he? A long-drawn grunt came to him. Funny. Seemed almost as though it were underground. Funny place to keep pigs. Couldn't be pigs. No. It was someone having a bit of shut-eye. A bit of shut-eye in the cellar, so it seemed. Right kind of a day for a snooze. A funny place to go for it. Humming like a bumblebee, Albert approached nearer. That's where it was coming from. Through that little grating. Grunt, 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 snore, snore, snore. Grunt, grunt, grunt. Funny sort of snore. Reminded him of something. Caw, said Albert. That's what it is. S.O.S. Dot, dot, dot. Dash, 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 dot, dot, dot. He looked round him with a quick glance. Then, kneeling down, he tapped a soft message on the iron grill of the little window of the cellar. Chapter 13. Although Tuppence went to bed in an optimistic frame of mind, she suffered a severe reaction in those waking hours of early dawn when human morale sinks to its lowest. On descending to breakfast, however, her spirits were raised by the sight of a letter sitting on her plate, addressed in a painfully backhanded script. This was no communication from Douglas, Raymond, or Cyril, or any other of the camouflaged correspondence that arrived punctually for her, and which included this morning a brightly coloured Bonzo postcard with a scrawled, "Sorry I haven't written before, all well, Maudie" on it. Tuppence thrust this aside and opened the letter. "Dear Patricia," it ran. "Auntie Grace is, I'm afraid, much worse today. The doctors do not actually say she is sinking, but I'm afraid that there cannot be much hope. If you want to see her before the end, I think it would be well to come today. If you will take the 10:20 train to Yarrow, a friend will meet you with his car. Shall look forward to seeing you again, dear, in spite of the melancholy reason. Yours ever, Penelope Plain." It was all Tuppence could do to restrain her jubilation. Good old Penny Plain! With some difficulty, She assumed a mourning expression and sighed heavily as she laid the letter down. To the two sympathetic listeners present, Mrs. O'Rourke and Miss Minton, she imparted the contents of the letter and enlarged freely on the personality of Aunt Gracie, her indomitable spirit, her indifference to air raids and danger, and her vanquishment by illness. Miss Minton tended to be curious as to the exact nature of Aunt Gracie's sufferings and compared them interestedly with the diseases of her own cousin Selina. Tuppence, hovering slightly between dropsy and diabetes, found herself slightly confused, but compromised on complications with the kidneys. Mrs. O'Rourke displayed an avid interest as to whether Tuppence would benefit pecuniarily by the old lady's death, and learned that dear Cyril had always been the old lady's favourite grand-nephew as well as being her godson. After breakfast, Tuppence rang up the tailor's and cancelled a fitting of a coat and skirt for that afternoon, and then sought out Mrs. Perenna and explained that she might be away from home for a night or two. Mrs. Perenna expressed the usual conventional sentiments. She looked tired this morning, and had an anxious, harassed expression. "Still no news of Mr. Meadows," she said. "It really is most odd, is it not?" "I'm sure he must have met with an accident," sighed Mrs. Blenkinsop. "I always said so." "Oh, but surely, Mrs. Blenkinsop, the accident would have been reported by this time." "Well, what do you think?" asked Tuppence. Mrs. Perenna shook her head. "I really don't know what to say. I quite agree that he can't have gone away of his own free will. He would have sent word by now." "Oh, it was always a most unjustified suggestion," said Mrs. Blenkinsop warmly. "That horrid Major Bletchley started it. No, if it isn't an accident, it must be a loss of memory. I believe that is far more common than is generally known, especially at times of stress like those we are living through." Mrs. Perenna nodded her head. She pursed up her lips with a rather doubtful expression. She shot a quick look at Tuppence. "You know, Mrs. Blenkinsop," she said, "we don't know very much about Mr. Meadows, do we?" Tuppence said sharply, "What do you mean?" "Oh, please, don't take me up so sharply. I don't believe it, not for a minute."
"Don't believe what?"
"This story that's going round."
"What story?"
"I haven't heard anything." "No, well, perhaps people wouldn't tell you. I don't really know how it started. I've an idea that Mr. Cayley mentioned it first. Of course, he's rather a suspicious man, if you know what I mean." Tuppence contained herself with as much patience as possible.
"Please tell me," she said.
"Well, it was just a suggestion, you know, that Mr. Meadows might be an enemy agent, one of those dreadful fifth column people."
Tuppence put all she could of an outraged Mrs. Blenkinsop into her indignant, "I never heard of such an absurd idea."
"Oh, no, I don't think there's anything in it. But of course, Mr. Meadows was seen about a good deal with that German boy, and I believe he asked a lot of questions about the chemical processes at the factory, and so people think that perhaps the two of them might have been working together."
Tuppence said, "Well, you don't think there's any doubt about Carl, do you, Mrs. Perenna?"
She saw a quick spasm distort the other woman's face. "I wish I could think it was not true." Tuppence said gently,
"Poor Sheila."
Mrs. Perenna's eyes flashed. "Her heart's broken, the poor child. Why should it be that way? Why couldn't it be someone else she set her heart upon?"
Tuppence shook her head. "Things don't happen that way."
"You're right." The other spoke in a deeply bitter voice. "It's got to be sorrow and bitterness and dust and ashes. It's got to be the way things tear you to pieces. I'm sick of the cruelty, the unfairness of this world. I'd like to smash it and break it, and let us all start again, near to the earth and without these rules and laws and the tyranny of nation over nation. I'd like—" A cough interrupted her, a deep, throaty cough. Mrs. O'Rourke was standing in the doorway, her vast bulk filling the aperture completely.
"Am I interrupting now?" she demanded.
Like a sponge across a slate, all evidence of Mrs. Perenna's outburst vanished from her face, leaving in their wake only the mild, worried face of the proprietress of a guest house, whose guests were causing trouble.
"No, indeed, Mrs. O'Rourke," she said. "We were just talking about what had become of Mr. Meadows.
It's amazing the police can find no trace of him."
"Ah, the police,"
said Mrs. O'Rourke, in tones of easy contempt.
"What good would they be? No good at all, at all. Only fit for fining motor cars and dropping on poor wretches who haven't taken out their dog licenses." "What's your theory, Mrs. O'Rourke?"
asked Tuppence. "You'll have been hearing the story that's going about."
"What about his being a fascist and an enemy agent?"
"Yes," said Tuppence coldly.
"It might be true now," said Mrs. O'Rourke thoughtfully, "for there's been something about the man that's intrigued me from the beginning. I've watched him, you know."
She smiled directly at Tuppence, and like all Mrs. O'Rourke's smiles, it had a vaguely terrifying quality, the smile of an ogress.
"He'd not the look of a man who'd retired from business and had nothing to do with himself. If I was backing my judgment, I'd say he came here with a purpose."
"And when the police got on his track, he disappeared, is that it?" demanded Tuppence.
"It might be so," said Mrs. O'Rourke. "What's your opinion, Mrs. Perenna?"
I don't know," sighed Mrs. Perenna. "It's a most vexing thing to happen. It makes so much talk."
"Ah, talk won't hurt you. They're happy now out there on the terrace, wondering and surmising. They'll have it in the end that the quiet, inoffensive man was going to blow us all up in our beds with bombs."
"You haven't told us what you think," said Tuppence. Mrs. O'Rourke smiled with that same slow, ferocious smile.
"I'm thinking that the man is safe somewhere. Quite safe."
Tuppence thought. She might say that if she knew. But he isn't where she thinks he is. She went up to her room to get ready. Betty Sprott came running out of the Cayleys' bedroom with a smile of mischievous and impish glee on her face.
"What have you been up to, Minx?" demanded Tuppence.
Betty gurgled,
"Goosey, goosey, gander."
Tuppence chanted, "Whither will you wander?"
"Upstairs?"
She snatched up Betty high over her head.
"Downstairs."
She rolled her on the floor. At this minute, Mrs. Sprott appeared and Betty was led off to be attired for her walk.
"Hide,"
said Betty hopefully.
"Hide." "You can't play hide and seek now,"
said Mrs. Sprott. Tuppence went into her room, donned her hat. A nuisance having to wear a hat. Tuppence Beresford never did, but Patricia Blenkinsop would certainly wear one, Tuppence felt. Somebody, she noted, had altered the position of the hats in her hat cupboard. Had someone been searching her room? Well, let them. They wouldn't find anything to cast doubt on blameless Mrs. Blenkinsop. She left Penelope Plain's letter artistically on the dressing table and went downstairs and out of the house. It was 10 o'clock as she turned out of the gate. Plenty of time. She looked up at the sky, and in doing so, stepped into a dark puddle by the gatepost. But without apparently noticing, she went on. Her heart was dancing wildly. Success, success, they were going to succeed. Yarrow was a small country station where the village was some distance from the railway. Outside the station, a car was waiting. A good-looking young man was driving it. He touched his peaked cap to Tuppence, but the gesture seemed hardly natural. Tuppence kicked the offside tire dubiously.
"Isn't this rather flat?"
"We haven't got far to go, madam." She nodded and got in. They drove, not towards the village, but towards the downs. After winding up over a hill, they took a side track that dropped sharply into a deep cleft. From the shadow of a small copse of trees, a figure stepped out to meet them. The car stopped, and Tuppence, getting out, went to meet Anthony Marsden. "Beresford's all right," he said quickly. "We located him yesterday. He's a prisoner. The other side got him, and for good reasons, he's remaining put for another 12 hours. You see, there's a small boat due in at a certain spot, and we want to catch her badly. That's why Beresford's lying low. We don't want to give the show away until the last minute." He looked at her anxiously. "You do understand, don't you?"
"Oh, yes."
Tuppence was staring at a curiously tangled mass of canvas material, half hidden by the trees. "He'll be absolutely all right," continued the young man earnestly.
"Well, of course Tommy will be all right," said Tuppence impatiently. "You needn't talk to me as though I were a child of 2. We're both ready to run a few risks. What's that thing over there?"
"Well," the young man hesitated, "that's just it. I've been ordered to put a certain proposition before you, but, well, frankly, I don't like doing it. You see..." Tuppence treated him to a cold stare. "Why don't you like doing it?"
"Well, dash it, you're Deborah's mother, and I mean, what would Deb say to me if
I got it in the neck?" inquired Tuppence.
Personally, if I were you, I shouldn't mention it to her. The man who said explanations were a mistake was quite right.
Then she smiled kindly at him. My dear boy, I know exactly how you feel. That it's all very well for you and Deborah, and the young generally, to run risks, but that the mere middle-aged must be shielded. All complete nonsense, because if anyone is going to be liquidated, it is much better it should be the middle-aged, who have had the best part of their lives. Anyway, stop looking upon me as that sacred object, Deborah's mother, and just tell me what dangerous and unpleasant job there is for me to do.
You know, said the young man with enthusiasm, I think you're splendid. Simply splendid.
Cut out the compliments, said Tuppence. I'm admiring myself a good deal, so there's no need for you to chime in. What exactly is the big idea?
Tony indicated the mass of crumpled material with a gesture.
That, he said, is the remains of a parachute.
Aha, said Tuppence. Her eyes sparkled.
There was just an isolated parachutist, went on Marsden. Fortunately, the LDVs around here are quite a bright lot. The descent was spotted, and they got her.
Her?
Yes, her. Woman dressed as a hospital nurse.
I'm sorry she wasn't a nun, said Tuppence. There have been so many good stories going round about nuns paying their fares in buses with hairy muscular arms.
Well, she wasn't a nun, and she wasn't a man in disguise. She was a woman of medium height, middle-aged, with dark hair and of slight build.
In fact, said Tuppence, a woman not unlike me.
You've hit it exactly, said Tony.
Well, said Tuppence.
Marsden said slowly, well, the next part of it is up to you. Tuppence smiled. She said, I'm on all right.
Where do I go and what do I do?
I say, Mrs. Beresford, you really are a sport. Magnificent nerve you've got.
Where do I go and what do I do?
Repeated Tuppence impatiently.
Well, the instructions are very meagre, unfortunately. In the woman's pocket there was a piece of paper with these words on it in German. Walk to Leatherbarrow, due east from the Stone Cross, 14, St. Asaph's Road, Dr. Binion.
Tuppence looked up. On the hilltop nearby was a stone cross.
That's it, said Tony.
Signposts have been removed, of course, but Leatherbarrow's a biggish place, and walking due east from the cross, you're bound to strike it.
How far?
5 miles at least.
Tuppence made a slight grimace.
Healthy walking exercise before lunch, she commented. I hope Dr. Binion offers me lunch when I get there.
Do you know German, Mrs. Beresford?
Hotel variety only. I shall have to be firm about speaking English. Say my instructions were to do so.
It's an awful risk, said Marsden.
Nonsense. Who's to imagine there's been a substitution? Or does everyone know for miles around that there's been a parachutist brought down?
The two LDV men who reported it are being kept by the chief constable. Don't want to risk their telling their friends how clever they've been.
Somebody else may have seen it, or heard about it.
Tony smiled.
My dear Mrs. Beresford, every single day word goes round that 1, 2, 3, 4, up to 100 parachutists have been seen.
That's probably quite true, agreed Tuppence.
Well, lead me to it. Tony said, we've got the kit here, and a policewoman who's an expert in the art of makeup. Come with me.
Just inside the copse, there was a tumble-down shed. At the door of it was a competent-looking middle-aged woman. She looked at Tuppence, and then nodded approvingly. Inside the shed, seated on an upturned packing case, Tuppence submitted herself to expert ministrations. Finally, the operator stood back, nodded approvingly, and remarked,
there now, I think we've made a very nice job of it.
What do you think, sir?
Very good indeed, said Tony.
Tuppence stretched out her hand and took the mirror the other woman held. She surveyed her own face earnestly, and could hardly repress a cry of surprise. The eyebrows had been trimmed to an entirely different shape, altering the whole expression. Small pieces of adhesive plaster, hidden by curls, had been pulled forward over the ears so that they tightened the skin of the face and altered its contours. A small amount of nose putty had altered the shape of the nose, giving Tuppence an unexpectedly beak-like profile. Skillful makeup had added several years to her age, with heavy lines running down each side of the mouth. The whole face had a complacent, rather foolish look.
It's frightfully clever, said Tuppence admiringly. She touched her nose gingerly.
Oh, you must be careful,
the other woman warned her. She produced two slices of thin India rubber.
Do you think you could bear to wear these in your cheeks?
I suppose I shall have to, said Tuppence gloomily. She slipped them in and worked her jaws carefully.
It's not really too uncomfortable, she had to admit.
Tony then discreetly left the shed, and Tuppence shed her own clothing and got into the nurse's kit. It was not too bad a fit, though inclined to strain a little over the shoulders. The dark blue bonnet put the final touch to her new personality. She rejected, however, the stout, square-toed shoes. If I've got to walk 5 miles, she said decidedly, I do it in my own shoes. They both agreed that this was reasonable, particularly as Tuppence's own shoes were dark blue brogues that went well with the uniform. She looked with interest into the dark blue handbag. Powder, no lipstick, £2.14 and 6 in English money, a handkerchief, and an identity card in the name of Frieda Elton, 4 Manchester Road, Sheffield. Tuppence transferred her own powder and lipstick and stood up, prepared to set out. Tony Marsden turned his head away. He said gruffly, I feel a swine letting you do this. I know just how you feel. But you see, it's absolutely vital that we should get some idea of just where and how the attack will come. Tuppence patted him on the arm. Don't you worry, my child. Believe it or not, I'm enjoying myself. Tony Marsden said again, I think you're simply wonderful. Somewhat weary, Tuppence stood outside 14 St. Asaph's Road and noted that Dr. Binion was a dental surgeon and not a doctor. From the corner of her eye, she noted Tony Marsden. He was sitting in a racy-looking car outside a house farther down the street. It had been judged necessary for Tuppence to walk to Leatherbarrow exactly as instructed, since if she had been driven there in a car, the fact might have been noted. It was certainly true that 2 enemy aircraft had passed over the downs, circling low before making off, and they could have noted the nurse's lonely figure walking across country. Tony, with the expert policewoman, had driven off in the opposite direction and had made a big detour before approaching Leatherbarrow and taking up his position in St. Asaph's Road. Everything was now set. The arena doors open, murmured Tuppence. Enter 1 Christian en route for the Lions. Oh well, nobody can say I'm not seeing life. She crossed the road and rang the bell, wondering as she did so exactly how much Deborah liked that young man. The door was opened by an elderly woman with a stolid, peasant face. Not an English face.
Dr. Binion, said Tuppence.
The woman looked her slowly up and down.
You will be Nurse Elton, I suppose.
Yes.
Then you will come up to the doctor's surgery.
She stood back. The door closed behind Tuppence, who found herself standing in a narrow, linoleum-lined hall. The maid preceded her upstairs and opened a door on the first floor.
Please to wait. The doctor will come to you.
She went out, shutting the door behind her. A very ordinary dentist surgery, the appointment somewhat old and shabby. Tuppence looked at the dentist's chair and smiled to think that for once it held none of the usual terrors. She had the dentist feeling, all right, but from quite different causes. Presently the door would open and Dr. Binion would come in. Who would Dr. Binion be? A stranger? Or someone she had seen before? If it was the person she was half expecting to see. The door opened. The man who entered was not at all the person Tuppence had half fancied she might see. It was someone she had never considered as a likely starter. It was Commander Haydock. Chapter 14. A flood of wild surmises as to the part Commander Haydock had played in Tommy's disappearance surged through Tuppence's brain, but she thrust them resolutely aside. This was a moment for keeping all her wits about her. Would or would not the commander recognize her? It was an interesting question. She had so steeled herself beforehand to display no recognition or surprise herself, no matter whom she might see, that she felt reasonably sure that she herself had displayed no signs untoward to the situation. She rose now to her feet and stood there, standing in a respectable attitude, as befitted a mere German woman in the presence of a lord of creation.
"So, you have arrived,"
said the commander. He spoke in English, and his manner was precisely the same as usual.
"Yes," said Tuppence, and added, as though presenting her credentials, "Nurse Elton."
Haydock smiled as though at a joke.
"Nurse Elton? Excellent."
He looked at her approvingly.
"You look absolutely right," he said kindly.
Tuppence inclined her head but said nothing. She was leaving the initiative to him.
"You know, I suppose, what you have to do," went on Haydock. "Sit down, please."
Tuppence sat down obediently. She replied, "I was to take detailed instruction from you."
"Very proper," said Haydock.
There was a faint suggestion of mockery in his voice. He said,
"You know the day?"
"The 4th.
Haydock looked startled. A heavy frown creased his forehead.
"So, you know that, do you?"
he muttered. There was a pause, then Tuppence said, "You will tell me, please, what I have to do."
Haydock said, "All in good time, my dear."
He paused a minute, and then asked,
"You have heard, no doubt, of Sanssouci?"
"No,"
said Tuppence.
"You haven't?"
"No,"
said Tuppence firmly.
"Let's see how you deal with this one," she thought.
There was a queer smile on the commander's face. He said,
"So, you haven't heard of Sanssouci? That surprises me very much, since I was under the impression, you know, that you'd been living there for the last month."
There was a dead silence.
The commander said, "What about that, Mrs. Blenkinsop?"
"I don't know what you mean, Dr. Binion."
"I landed by parachute this morning."
Again Haydock smiled, definitely an unpleasant smile. He said,
"A few yards of canvas thrust into a bush create a wonderful illusion. And I am not Dr. Binion, dear lady. Dr. Binion is officially my dentist. He's good enough to lend me his surgery now and again."
"Indeed,"
said Tuppence. "Indeed, Mrs. Blenkinsop. Or perhaps you would prefer me to address you by your real name, of Beresford."
Again there was a poignant silence. Tuppence drew a deep breath. Haydock nodded.
"The game's up, you see." "You've walked into my parlour," said the spider to the fly.
There was a faint click and a gleam of blue steel showed in his hand. His voice took on a grim note as he said,
"And I shouldn't advise you to make any noise or try to arouse the neighbourhood. You'd be dead before you got so much as a yelp out, and even if you did manage to scream, it wouldn't arouse attention. Patients under gas, you know, often cry out."
Tuppence said composedly,
"You seem to have thought of everything.
Has it occurred to you that I have friends who know where I am?"
"Ha! Still harping on the blue-eyed boy.
Actually, brown-eyed. Young Anthony Marsden. I'm sorry, Mrs. Beresford, but young Anthony happens to be one of our most stalwart supporters in this country. As I said just now, a few yards of canvas creates a wonderful effect. You swallowed the parachute idea quite easily."
"I don't see the point of all this rigmarole."
"Don't you? We don't want your friends to trace you too easily, you see. If they pick up your trail, it will lead to Yarrow, and to a man in a car. The fact that a hospital nurse of quite different facial appearance walked into Leatherbarrow between 1 and 2 will hardly be connected with your disappearance."
"Very elaborate," said Tuppence.
Haydock said, "I admire your nerve, you know." "I admire it very much. I'm sorry to have to coerce you, but it's vital that we should know just exactly how much you did discover at Sanssouci."
Tuppence did not answer. Haydock said quietly, "I advise you, you know, to come clean. There are certain possibilities in a dentist's chair and instruments." Tuppence merely threw him a scornful look. Haydock leant back in his chair. He said slowly,
"Yes, I dare say you've got a lot of fortitude. Your type often has. But what about the other half of the picture?"
"What do you mean?"
"I'm talking about Thomas Beresford, your husband, who has lately been living at Sanssouci under the name of Mr. Meadows, and who is now very conveniently trussed up in the cellar of my house."
Tuppence said sharply, "I don't believe it."
"Because of the Penny Plain letter? Don't you realize that that was just a bit of smart work on the part of young Anthony? You played into his hands nicely when you gave him the code.
Tuppence's voice trembled.
Tommy, said Commander Haydock, is where he has been all along, completely in my power.
It's up to you now.
If you answer my question satisfactorily, there's a chance for him. If you don't, well, the original plan holds.
He'll be knocked on the head, taken out to sea and put overboard.
Tuppence was silent for a minute or two. Then she said, What do you want to know?
I want to know who employed you, what your means of communication with that person or persons are, what you've reported so far, and exactly what you know.
Tuppence shrugged her shoulders.
I could tell you what lies I choose, she pointed out.
No, because I shall proceed to test what you say.
He drew his chair a little nearer. His manner was now definitely appealing.
My dear woman, I know just what you feel about it all. But believe me, when I say I really do admire both you and your husband immensely, you've got grit and pluck. It's people like you that will be needed in the new state, the state that will arise in this country when your present imbecile government is vanquished. We want to turn some of our enemies into friends, those that are worthwhile. If I have to give the order that ends your husband's life, I shall do it. It's my duty. But I shall feel really badly about having to do it. He's a fine fellow. Quiet, unassuming, and clever. Let me impress upon you what so few people in this country seem to understand. Our leader does not intend to conquer this country in the sense that you all think. He aims at creating a new Britain, a Britain strong in its own power, ruled over not by Germans but by Englishmen, and the best type of Englishmen, Englishmen with brains and breeding and courage, a brave new world, as Shakespeare puts it. He leaned forward. We want to do away with muddle and inefficiency, with bribery and corruption, with self-seeking and money-grabbing. And in this new state, we want people like you and your husband, brave and resourceful, enemies that have been, friends to be. You would be surprised if you knew how many people there are in this country, as in others, who have sympathy with and belief in our aims. Between us, we will create a new Europe, a Europe of peace and progress. Try and see it that way, because I assure you it is that way.
His voice was compelling, magnetic. Leaning forward, he looked the embodiment of a straightforward British sailor.
Tuppence looked at him and searched her mind for a telling phrase. She was only able to find one that was both childish and rude.
Goosey, goosey gander, said Tuppence.
The effect was so magical that she was quite taken aback. Haydock jumped to his feet. His face went dark purple with rage, and in a second all likeness to a hearty British sailor had vanished. She saw what Tommy had once seen, an infuriated Prussian. He swore at her fluently in German. Then, changing to English, he shouted,
You infernal little fool! Don't you realize you give yourself away completely answering like that? You've done for yourself now, you and your precious husband!
Raising his voice, he called,
Anna!
The woman who had admitted Tuppence came into the room. Haydock thrust the pistol into her hand.
Watch her! Shoot if necessary!
He stormed out of the room. Tuppence looked appealingly at Anna, who stood in front of her with an impassive face.
Would you really shoot me? Said Tuppence.
Anna answered quietly.
You need not try to get round me. In the last war my son was killed. My Otto. I was 38 then. I am 62 now, but I have not forgotten.
Tuppence looked at the broad, impassive face. It reminded her of the Polish woman, Wanda Polonska. That same frightening ferocity and singleness of purpose. Motherhood, unrelenting. So, no doubt, felt many quiet Mrs. Joneses and Mrs. Smiths all over England. There was no arguing with the female of the species. The mother deprived of her young. Something stirred in the recesses of Tuppence's brain, some nagging recollection, something that she had always known but had never succeeded in getting into the forefront of her mind. Solomon. Solomon came into it somewhere. The door opened. Commander Haydock came back into the room. He howled out beside himself with rage,
Where is it? Where have you hidden it?
Tuppence stared at him. She was completely taken aback. What he was saying did not make sense to her. She had taken nothing and hidden nothing. Haydock said to Anna, "Get out!" The woman handed the pistol to him and left the room promptly. Haydock dropped into a chair and seemed to be striving to pull himself together. He said, "You can't get away with it, you know. I've got you. And I've got ways of making people speak, not pretty ways. You'll have to tell the truth in the end. Now then, what have you done with it?" Tuppence was quick to see that here, at least, was something that gave her the possibility of bargaining. If only she could find out what it was she was supposed to have in her possession. She said cautiously, "How do you know I've got it?" "From what you said, you damned little fool. You haven't got it on you, that we know, since you changed completely into this kit." "Suppose I posted it to someone," said Tuppence. "Don't be a fool. Everything you posted since yesterday has been examined. You didn't post it." "No. There's only one thing you could have done. Hidden it at Sans Souci before you left this morning. I give you just 3 minutes to tell me where that hiding place is." He put his watch down on the table. 3 minutes, Mrs. Beresford." The clock on the mantelpiece ticked. Tuppence sat quite still, with a blank, impassive face. It revealed nothing of the racing thoughts behind it. In a flash of bewildering light, she saw everything, saw the whole business revealed in terms of blinding clarity, and realized at last who was the center and pivot of the whole organization. It came quite as a shock to her when Haydock said, 10 seconds more. Like one in a dream, she watched him, saw the pistol arm rise, heard him count, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. He had reached 8 when the shot rang out, and he collapsed forward on his chair, an expression of bewilderment on his broad red face. So intent had he been on watching his victim that he'd been unaware of the door behind him slowly opening. In a flash, Tuppence was on her feet. She pushed her way past the uniformed men in the doorway and seized on a tweed-clad arm.
"Mr. Grant!"
"Yes. Yes, my dear, it's all right now. You've been wonderful." Tuppence brushed aside these reassurances. "Quick! There's no time to lose. You've got a car here?" "Yes." He stared. "A fast one? We must get to Sans Souci at once. If only we're in time before they telephone here and get no answer." 2 minutes later, they were in the car, and it was threading its way through the streets of Leatherbarrow. Then they were out in the open country, and the needle of the speedometer was rising. Mr. Grant asked no questions. He was content to sit quietly, whilst Tuppence watched the speedometer in an agony of apprehension. The chauffeur had been given his orders, and he drove with all the speed of which the car was capable. Tuppence only spoke once. "Tommy?" "Quite all right. Released 30 minutes ago. She nodded. Now, at last, they were nearing Leehampton. They darted and twisted through the town, up the hill. Tuppence jumped out, and she and Mr. Grant ran up the drive. The hall door, as usual, was open. There was no one in sight. Tuppence ran lightly up the stairs. She just glanced inside her own room in passing and noted the confusion of open drawers and disordered bed. She nodded and passed on along the corridor and into the room occupied by Mr. and Mrs. Cayley. The room was empty. It looked peaceful and smelt slightly of medicines. Tuppence ran across to the bed and pulled at the coverings. They fell to the ground, and Tuppence ran her hand under the mattress. She turned triumphantly to Mr. Grant with a tattered child's picture book in her hand. "Here you are. It's all in here." "What on—" They turned. Mrs. Sprott was standing in the doorway, staring. "And now," said Tuppence, "let me introduce you to M." "Yes. Mrs. Sprott. I ought to have known it all along." It was left to Mrs. Cayley, arriving in the doorway a moment later, to introduce the appropriate anticlimax.
"Oh, dear,"
said Mrs. Cayley, looking with dismay at her spouse's dismantled bed.
"Oh, dear. Whatever will Mr. Cayley say?"
Chapter 15. "I ought to have known it all along," said Tuppence. She was reviving her shattered nerves by a generous tot of old brandy, and was beaming alternately at Tommy and at Mr. Grant and at Albert, who was sitting in front of a pint of beer and grinning from ear to ear. "Tell us all about it, Tuppence," urged Tommy.
"You first," said Tuppence.
"Well, there's not much for me to tell," said Tommy.
Sheer accident let me into the secret of the wireless transmitter. I thought I'd get away with it, but Haydock was too smart for me.
Tuppence nodded and said, "He telephoned to Mrs. Sprott at once, and she ran out into the drive and laid in wait for you with a hammer. She was only away from the bridge table for about 3 minutes. I did notice she was a little out of breath, but I never suspected her."
"After that," said Tommy, "the credit belongs entirely to Albert. He came sniffing round like a faithful dog. I did some impassioned more snoring, and he cottoned onto it. He went off to Mr. Grant with the news, and the two of them came back late that night. More snoring. Result was, I agreed to remain put so as to catch the sea forces when they arrived."
Mr. Grant added his quota.
"When Haydock went off this morning, our people took charge at Smuggler's Rest. We nabbed the boat this evening. And now, Tuppence," said Tommy, "your story."
"Well, to begin with, I've been the most frightful fool all along. I suspected everybody here except Mrs. Sprott. I did once have a terrible feeling of menace, as though I was in danger. That was after I overheard the telephone message about the 4th of the month. There were 3 people there at the time. I put down my feeling of apprehension to either Mrs. Perenna or Mrs. O'Rourke. Quite wrong. It was the colourless Mrs. Sprott who was the really dangerous personality. I went muddling on, as Tommy knows, until after he disappeared. Then I was just cooking up a plan with Albert when suddenly, out of the blue, Anthony Marsden turned up. It seemed all right to begin with, the usual sort of young man that Deb often has in tow. But 2 things made me think a bit. First, I became more and more sure as I talked to him that I hadn't seen him before, and that he never had been to the flat. The second was that, though he seemed to know all about my working in Leehampton, he assumed that Tommy was in Scotland. Now that seemed all wrong. If he knew about anyone, it would be Tommy he knew about, since I was more or less unofficial. That struck me as very odd. Mr. Grant had told me that 5th columnists were everywhere, in the most unlikely places, so why shouldn't one of them be working in Deborah's show? I wasn't convinced, but I was suspicious enough to lay a trap for him. I told him that Tommy and I had fixed up a code for communicating with each other. Our real one, of course, was a Bonzo postcard, but I told Anthony a fairy tale about the penny plain Tuppence Coloured saying. As I hoped, he rose to it beautifully. I got a letter this morning which gave him away completely. The arrangements had been all worked out beforehand. All I had to do was ring up a tailor and cancel a fitting. That was an intimation that the fish had risen.
"Caw," said Albert. "It didn't half give me a turn. I drove up with a baker's van, and we dumped a pool of stuff just outside the gate. Aniseed it was, or it smelt like it."
"And then," Tuppence took up the tale, "I came out and walked in it. Of course, it was easy for the baker's van to follow me to the station, and someone came up behind me and heard me book to Yarrow. It was after that it might have been difficult."
"The dogs followed the scent well," said Mr. Grant. "They picked it up at Yarrow Station, and again on the track the tire had made after you rubbed your shoe on it. It led us down to the copse, and up again to the stone cross, and after you where you had walked over the downs. The enemy had no idea we could follow you easily after they themselves had seen you start and driven off themselves."
"All the same," said Albert, "it gave me a turn, knowing you were in that house and not knowing what might come to you. Got in a back window, we did, and nabbed the foreign woman as she came down the stairs. Come in just in the nick of time, we did."
"I knew you'd come," said Tuppence. "The thing was for me to spin things out as long as I could. I'd have pretended to tell if I hadn't seen the door opening. What was really exciting was the way I suddenly saw the whole thing, and what a fool I'd been."
"Well, how did you see it?" asked Tommy.
"Goosey, goosey, gander," said Tuppence promptly. "When I said that to Commander Haydock, he went absolutely livid, and not just because it was silly and rude. No, I saw at once that it meant something to him. And then there was the expression on that woman's face, Anna. It was like the Polish woman's. And then, of course, I thought of Solomon, and I saw the whole thing."
Tommy gave a sigh of exasperation.
"Tuppence, if you say that once again, I'll shoot you myself. Saw all what? And what on earth has Solomon got to do with it?"
"Do you remember that 2 women came to Solomon with a baby and both said it was hers, but Solomon said, 'Very well, cut it in 2. And the false mother said, 'All right,' but the real mother said, 'No, let the other woman have it.' You see, she couldn't face her child being killed. Well, that night that Mrs. Sprott shot the other woman, you all said what a miracle it was and how easily she might have shot the child. Of course, it ought to have been quite plain then.
If it had been her child, she couldn't have risked that shot for a minute. It meant that Betty wasn't her child, and that's why she absolutely had to shoot the other woman. Why? Because, of course, the other woman was the child's real mother. Poor thing. Poor hunted thing. She came over a penniless refugee and gratefully agreed to let Mrs. Sprott adopt her baby. But why did Mrs. Sprott want to adopt the child? Camouflage. Supreme psychological camouflage. You just can't conceive of a master spy dragging her kid into the business. That's the main reason why I never considered Mrs. Sprott seriously, simply because of the child. But Betty's real mother had a terrible hankering for her baby, and she found out Mrs. Sprott's address and came down here. She hung about waiting for her chance, and at last she got it and went off with the child. Mrs. Sprott, of course, was frantic. At all costs, she didn't want the police. So she wrote that message and pretended she found it in her bedroom and roped in Commander Haydock to help. Then, when we tracked down the wretched woman, she was taking no chances and shot her. Far from not knowing anything about firearms, she was a very fine shot. Yes, she killed that wretched woman, and because of that I've no pity for her. She was bad through and through. Tuppence paused, then she went on. Another thing that ought to have given me a hint was the likeness between Vanda Polonska and Betty. It was Betty, the woman reminded me of all along. And then the child's absurd play with my shoelaces. How much more likely that she'd seen her so-called mother do that, not Carl von Dynam. But as soon as Mrs. Sprott saw what the child was doing, she planted a lot of evidence in Carl's room for us to find, and added the master touch of a shoelace dipped in secret ink. I'm glad that Carl wasn't in it, said Tommy. I liked him. He's not been shot, has he? Asked Tuppence anxiously, noting the past tense. Mr. Grant shook his head. He's all right, he said. As a matter of fact, I've got a little surprise for you there. Tuppence's face lit up as she said, oh, I'm terribly glad, for Sheila's sake. Of course we were idiots to go barking up the wrong tree after Mrs. Perenna. Well, she was mixed up in some IRA activities. Nothing more, said Mr. Grant. I suspected Mrs. O'Rourke a little, and sometimes the Cayleys. And I suspected Bletchley, put in Tommy. And all the time, said Tuppence, it was that milk-and-water creature we just thought of as Betty's mother. Hardly milk-and-water, said Mr. Grant. A very dangerous woman, and a very clever actress. And I'm sorry to say, English by birth. Tuppence said, then I've no pity or admiration for her. It wasn't even her country she was working for. She looked with fresh curiosity at Mr. Grant. You found what you wanted? Mr. Grant nodded. It was all in that battered set of duplicate children's books. The ones that Betty said were nasty, Tuppence exclaimed. They were nasty, said Mr. Grant dryly. Little Jack Horner contained very full details of our naval dispositions. Johnny Head in Air did the same for the Air Force. Military matters were appropriately embodied in There Was a Little Man, and He Had a Little Gun. And Goosey Goosey Gander? Asked Tuppence. Mr. Grant said, treated with the appropriate reagent. That book contains, written in invisible ink, a full list of all prominent personages who were pledged to assist an invasion of this country. Amongst them were two chief constables, an air vice marshal, two generals, the head of an armaments works, a cabinet minister, many police superintendents, commanders of local volunteer defense organizations, and various military and naval lesser fry, as well as members of our own intelligence force. Tommy and Tuppence stared. Incredible, said the former. Grant shook his head. You do not know the force of the German propaganda. It appeals to something in man, some desire or lust for power. These people were ready to betray their country not for money, but in a kind of megalomaniacal pride in what they themselves were going to achieve for that country. In every land it has been the same. It is the cult of Lucifer. Lucifer, son of the morning, pride, and a desire for personal glory. He added, you can realize that with such persons to issue contradictory orders and confuse operations, how the threatened invasion would have had every chance to succeed.
And now? Said Tuppence.
Mr. Grant smiled. And now, he said, let them come. We'll be ready for them. Chapter 16.
Darling, said Deborah, do you know, I almost thought the most terrible things about you.
Did you? Said Tuppence.
When?
Her eyes rested affectionately on her daughter's dark head.
Well, that time when you sloped off to Scotland to join Father, and I thought you were with Aunt Gracie. I almost thought you were having an affair with someone.
Oh, Deb, did you?
Well, not really, of course, not at your age. And of course I knew you and Carrot Top were devoted to each other. It was really an idiot called Tony Marsden who put it into my head.
Do you know, Mother, I think I might tell you. He was found afterwards to be a fifth columnist. He always did talk rather oddly. How things would be just the same, perhaps better, if Hitler did win.
Did you, like him at all?
Tony?
Oh, no. He was always rather a bore. Oh, I must dance this.
She floated away, in the arms of a fair-haired young man, smiling up at him sweetly. Tuppence followed their revolutions for a few minutes. Then her eyes shifted to where a tall young man in Air Force uniform was dancing with a fair-haired, slender girl.
I do think, Tommy, said Tuppence, that our children are rather nice.
Here's Sheila, said Tommy. He got up as Sheila Perenna came across to their table. She was dressed in an emerald evening dress, which showed up her dark beauty. It was a sullen beauty tonight, and she greeted her host and hostess somewhat ungraciously.
I've come, you see, she said, as I promised, but I can't think why you wanted to ask me.
Because we like you, said Tommy, smiling.
Do you really? Said Sheila.
I can't think why. I've been perfectly foul to both of you. She paused and murmured, but I am grateful. Tuppence said, we must find a nice partner to dance with you.
I don't want to dance. I loathe dancing.
I came just to see you two.
You will like the partner we've asked to meet you, said Tuppence, smiling.
Sheila began, then stopped. For Carl von Dynam was walking across the floor.
Sheila looked at him like one dazed. She muttered, you?
I myself, said Carl. There was something a little different about Carl von Dynam this evening. He seemed to have lost his German accent.
Sheila stared at him, a trifle perplexed. The colour had come up on her cheeks, turning them a deep, glowing red.
She said a little breathlessly,
I knew that you would be all right now, but I thought they would still keep you interned.
Carl shook his head. There is no reason to intern me. He went on, you have to forgive me, Sheila, for deceiving you. I am not, you see, Carl von Dynam at all. I took his name for reasons of my own. He looked questioningly at Tuppence, who said, go ahead, tell her. Carl von Dynam was my friend. I knew him in England some years ago. I renewed acquaintanceship with him in Germany just before the war. I was there then on special business for this country.
You were in the intelligence? Asked Sheila.
Yes. When I was there, queer things began to happen. Once or twice I had some very near escapes. My plans were known when they should not have been known. I realized that there was something wrong and that the rot, to express it in their terms, had penetrated actually into the service in which I was. I had been let down by my own people. Carl and I had a certain superficial likeness. My grandmother was a German, hence my suitability for work in Germany. Carl was not a Nazi. He was interested solely in his job, a job I myself had also practiced, research chemistry. He decided, shortly before war broke out, to escape to England. His brothers had been sent to concentration camps. There would, he thought, be great difficulties in the way of his own escape. But in an almost miraculous fashion, all these difficulties smoothed themselves out. The fact, when he mentioned it to me, made me somewhat suspicious. Why were the authorities making it so easy for von Dynam to leave Germany when his brothers and other relations were in concentration camps, and he himself was suspected because of his anti-Nazi sympathies? It seemed as though they wanted him in England for some reason.
My own position was becoming increasingly precarious. Carl's lodgings were in the same house as mine, and one day I found him, to my sorrow, lying dead on his bed. He had succumbed to depression and taken his own life, leaving a letter behind which I read and pocketed. I decided then to effect a substitution. I wanted to get out of Germany, and I wanted to know why Carl was being encouraged to do so. I dressed his body in my clothes and laid it on my bed. It was disfigured by the shot he had fired into his head. My landlady, I knew, was semi-blind. With Carl von Deinem's papers, I travelled to England and went to the address to which he had been recommended to go. The address was Sans Souci. Whilst I was there, I played the part of Carl von Deinem and never relaxed. I found arrangements had been made for me to work in a chemical factory there. At first, I thought that the idea was that I should be compelled to do work for the Nazis. I realized later that the part for which my poor friend had been cast was that of scapegoat. When I was arrested on fake evidence, I said nothing. I wanted to leave the revelation of my own identity as late as possible. I wanted to see what would happen. It was only a few days ago that I was recognized by one of our people, and the truth came out. Sheila said reproachfully, "You should have told me." He said gently, "If you feel like that, I'm sorry." His eyes looked into hers. She looked at him angrily and proudly. Then the anger melted. She said, "I suppose you had to do what you did." "Darling," he caught himself up, "come and dance." They moved off together. Tuppence sighed. "What's the matter?" said Tommy. "I do hope Sheila will go on caring for him, now that he isn't a German outcast, with everyone against him. She looks as though she cares all right." "Yes, but the Irish are terribly perverse, and Sheila is a born rebel." "Why did he search your room that day? That's what led us up the garden path so terribly." Tuppence gave a laugh. "I gather he thought Mrs. Blenkinsop wasn't a very convincing person. In fact, while we were suspecting him, he was suspecting us." "Hello, you two," said Derek Beresford, as he and his partner danced past his parents' table. "Why don't you come and dance?" He smiled encouragingly at them. "They're so kind to us, bless 'em," said Tuppence. Presently, the twins and their partners returned and sat down. Derek said to his father, "Glad you got a job, all right. Not very interesting, I suppose." "Oh, mainly routine," said Tommy. "Never mind. You're doing something, that's the great thing." "And I'm glad Mother was allowed to go and work too," said Deborah. "She looks ever so much happier." "It wasn't too dull, was it, Mother?" "Oh, I didn't find it dull at all," said Tuppence. "Good," said Deborah. She added, "When the war's over, I'll be able to tell you something about my job. It's really frightfully interesting, but very confidential." "How thrilling," said Tuppence. "Oh, it is. Of course, it's not so thrilling as flying." She looked enviously at Derek. She said, "He's going to be recommended for..." Derek said quickly, "Shut up, Deb." Tommy said, "Hello, Derek, what have you been up to?" "Oh, nothing much. Sort of show all of us are doing. Don't know why they pitched on me," murmured the young airman, his face scarlet. He looked as embarrassed as though he'd been accused of the most deadly of sins. He got up, and the fair-haired girl got up too. Derek said, "Oh, mustn't miss any of this. Last night I might leave." "Come on, Charles," said Deborah. The two of them floated away with their partners. Tuppence prayed inwardly. "Oh, let them be safe. Don't let anything happen to them." She looked up to meet Tommy's eyes. He said, "About that child, shall we? Betty?" "Oh, Tommy, I'm glad you've thought of it too. I thought it was just me being maternal." "You really mean it?"
"What, that we should adopt her?"
"Why not? She's had a raw deal. It'll be fun for us to have something young growing up."
"Oh, Tommy."
She stretched out her hand and squeezed his. They looked at each other.
"We always do want the same things," said Tuppence happily.
Deborah, passing Derek on the floor, murmured to him,
"Just look at those two.
actually holding hands. They're rather sweet, aren't they? You know, we must do all we can to make up to them for having such a dull time in this war.